Hello, and welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis, your host, and our guest tonight is a repeat guest, Klas Vaughn from Sweden. I always enjoy our discussion, and I'm sure you will as well. And we're going to be talking about all kinds of interesting topics tonight. And Klas is chairman of, or for the Archives of the Unexplained, otherwise known as AFU. We're going to be talking about that. He's also the international director of UFO Sweden, among many other hats that he wears. Klas will be coming up in just a few minutes here. I do want to thank everyone for helping out and supporting the show. Anyone can do that. You can see our Patreon banner over at our website at podcastufo.com. And while you're there, check out our blog this week from Charles Lear. And this week's blog is called UFOs in the 21st Century. It's a great one. Another great blog that I forgot to mention last week is titled UFOs, Spacemen, Ultraterrestrials, or What? The Strange Case of Woodrow Derringberger. And strange... We're getting some feedback here. That was strange. I'm not sure where the feedback's coming from. Anyway, it sounded great, actually. So that is a really that's an interesting case, I was saying. And there's an audio interview, so check that out. That happened back in 1966. He was interviewed, I think, the next day. And so that clip is up there, too, in that blog. I've mentioned several times over the last... several years that Australia is, well, actually per capita is our number one listener to this show. And I want to give a shout out to all those people in Australia and let you know that we are thinking about you. And it's a terrible, these bushfires out there. I feel so bad for all the people that are misplaced and all the poor animals out there. It's really terrible. So hang in there, Australia. Also, in the news, there's a lot of people writing me about the Navy. You know, it seems like every week I get something, someone's writing me about the Navy. And headlines that were sent out this week, top secret UFO files could gravely damage U.S. national security if released, the Navy says. And it does seem like the Navy has been very outspoken about the UFO topic these days. And that's almost as mysterious as UFOs themselves. And I'm wondering what the heck the agenda is, if any, if the Navy has an agenda. It's interesting. And we will know eventually. That's all I can say. But for now, it's just a mystery. And I think it's time to pull in our guest, Klas Vaughn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Martin. I'm glad to be back.
Yes, and it's midnight over there, so I really appreciate you staying up late for us over here on the East Coast.
Oh, not a problem. It's dark and wintry, but no snow here in Sweden at all.
Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of people have been writing me and saying, oh, you poor thing, you got all the snow. I'm right on the coast, so I right now we just have a little dusting, and that's it. We've been really lucky this year, so I'll take it. Not much of a fan of snow, but so Klas, can you, for the person that I think it was over a year ago you were on last time, but for the person that is unaware of your, you know, who you are basically, can you give them your background in kind of a nutshell, because a lot of people have heard you a number of times?
Yeah, I've been around as a ufologist since 1974 when I started a small UFO society in my hometown in the south of Sweden. And since then, I spent nearly every day a couple of hours researching UFO cases. And I'm interested in the topic because I really want to know the answer. I haven't all the answers. I want to know what people see in the sky, and I try to help people to identify what they see in the skies. But what is left, the real UFOs, that is, of course, the thing that gets me ticking. And I've been a chairman for UFO Sweden for many, many years. But since a couple of years back, we decided that some younger person than me should take over, and I'm now vice chairman, and I work a lot with international contacts in UFO Sweden, which is very important. And I also, of course, chairman for Archives for the Unexplained, which is this huge archive we run.
Yes, the archive, that it's really amazing. You and I have talked before about, I think you were telling me your shelves, the shelf space you have of UFO-related books is, there's none other in the world, right?
No, it's the largest in the world, really. It's nothing to compare with. We started in 1973 in one locality in the south of Sweden. And now we have 14 localities in the same area in Norrköping, which is 500 square meters, 600 square yards, and a shelf capacity of 3 kilometers, which is nearly 5 miles. So, yeah, we started with one bookshelf, and now we have several.
Wow.
And the library is 55,000 books and 80,000 magazines and more than 50,000 case files from different countries, millions of documents and newspaper clippings, recordings, and, yeah, TV programs, paraphernalia. We collect everything regarding the unknown, from UFOs to ghosts.
And is that open to the public? Like, can someone come in and do some research there themselves?
Yes, we are open to the public. And, of course, if you are knocking our door, we can help you. But we can also help you through internet and through a special download site that we have. We publish magazines that we are scanning all the time, which we have the clearance from the copyright holder. We publish them on our download site, so you can go there. But you can email us and ask for help, and dfu.se. We are there for everyone, really, who is interested in the topic.
I really like visuals, and this, I'm going to hold up your book here. Let's see. I think I can do that here. Hang on just a second. Well, I had a screen where I could just pull in on this, but I'm not seeing where it is. Let's try this. Okay. All right. So it's called, I'm just trying to adjust it there, Files of the Unexplained.
Yeah.
And, the Hidden History of the Forgotten Photographs from the World of the Unknown. And it's a great, I love this book. Thank you for sending it, by the way. But there's so many wonderful graphics in this all the way through and all the way up to modern times. You have quite a variety in there. And what is the earliest book you have on the shelf that talks about UFOs?
Well, if you go back to the oldest book at all, it's from the 1600s about Nostradamus. But we have, of course, books from Charles Fort, his early books from the early 1900s, which probably is the oldest real UFO books. But we go further back, we have books that are older as well, when enigmas or mysteries in disguise did not have any label. They were just called meteors, which is at that time was the name for strange things that you could see in the skies. So we have around 55,000 books. Of course, many of them are oldies, but lots of them are newer ones as well.
And what about the languages? Do you have them in multiple languages?
Yeah, of course, most of them are in English, but we have a very large collection in Russian. We had a guy from Tokyo coming to us looking through our Japanese collections. He stayed for a couple of days. We have really any language that we can collect, lots of French books, and of course every European language we can find.
Wow, interesting. And so where do you get all this material anyway?
Yeah, we get it from all over the world. A lot come from Great Britain and the Nordic countries, of course, but also the rest of Europe and the U.S. And when we get surplus books and magazines, we sell them through our shop, AFU shop, so we can get money, and we can also help researchers from all over the world to get titles that they cannot find on Amazon or anywhere else, really. We have so many hard-to-find books, and we have maybe multiple copies of them, so we can help researchers with them.
Now, I remember the last time we talked, and this baffles me, it's that your country basically takes this topic seriously, or you get very little ridicule, if any. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They're still right, and it's very much up to UFO Sweden and our work, I should say, because we have always been treated very good from the authorities, but maybe not always, but the last 30 years or something like that, because we have shown them that we are a serious partner, that we don't have the answers, we are not speculating, we want to know what UFOs are, and of course they want as well. So we have now copies of I think every single UFO report that have passed through the Swedish Defense Authorities since the early 1900s up till a couple of years back. And that is a very, very good cooperation.
Wow. And that includes the ghost rockets?
Absolutely. It includes the ghost flyers from the 1930s and the ghost rockets. The ghost flyers are not that very well known as the ghost rockets, but just a couple of weeks ago, we got all the printed papers from the Swedish War Archives regarding the ghost flyers, which was an early UFO phenomenon, scanned. It's thousands of 5,500 scanned pages of reports and investigations into this early 1930s phenomenon that really baffled the Swedish military for many years.
Wow. Because, you know, I mean, for the most part, people will talk about, you know, the modern UFO era as 1947 Roswell on. But there was and then, of course, there were the Foo Fighters that people were seeing during World War II. But yeah. not like what you seem to be talking about. Can you go into more detail about you said there were 5,000 scans. So can you go into more detail about what people thought they were seeing?
Yeah, I mean, it was during a couple of years in the middle of the 1930s that people saw first lights in the sky, which, I mean, people do nowadays as well. But they were flying in very strange patterns and over areas that were controlled by the military. But they also saw what they thought were aircraft coming, flying over the northern part of Sweden, their aircraft chasing this ghost flyer. But they never caught him or were even near him. Some of them, this aircraft, one of them at least, crashed. So it was up under parliamentary discussion, and they were really, really interested in pinpointing which country. They thought it was the Germans, maybe the Russians, who did those flyovers over Sweden and intrusions over Sweden. But they never really got the hang of it. Most of the observations were, of course, misinterpretations, as always. But some of them are still a little strange.
Wow. And then I always love talking about the ghost rockets. 1946, is that when that was happening?
Yeah.
And for the person that's not from, and they landed in, a lot of them landed in lakes, which is another mystery. For the person that's unfamiliar with the ghost rockets, can you get a little bit into that topic, please?
Yeah, to me, the ghost rockets is the most interesting UFO phenomenon ever, I think, because they were seen during 1946, around May, up until December of that year. And as you said, many of those rockets, they looked like cigars, with or without small wings, and some of them were crashing into lakes. And the interesting thing was that everyone that did crash always crashed into a lake, and it was nearly always around 11, 12 o'clock in the middle of the day, broad daylight, and also sunshine, and you could see the sun shining on the hull of those rockets. You can hear them. You can see the water column when they were crashing, and you can also hear the crash. And even though the military spent thousands of hours trying to find a solution. They never did. They thought they were the Russians, of course, but I don't think it was them, neither the military. They could never prove that there were any country that were driving those rockets.
And what did they report as far as the sound? What were they hearing for a sound?
Well, they were hearing like a motor, like an engine. And they were really looking like cigar-shaped objects. They were very much like the V-bombs that Nazi Germany used during the last years of the Second World War. But compared to the V-bombs, when they crashed, the V-bombs left debris, maybe thousands of kilos, a couple of tons of debris. But those ghost rockets never left anything, not a trace after them. So even though they looked like rockets, they didn't behave like rockets, and they didn't were identified as rockets either.
Didn't you, I may be thinking of something else, but didn't someone see one more recently than 1946, like a couple or something that was hiking?
You know, we have multiple observations after 1946, quite a few. But the one that you are thinking about happened in 1980, in summer 1980, when a couple were out hiking up in the very north of Sweden. It was in a national park called Muddus National Park. And they were walking home, back to their car, which was a couple of hours down the road. And they stopped to take a break. When they were standing there at the end of this lake, Lake Namajaure, they heard strange sound from the south, and they looked up and they saw this small missile-like object with protrusions on both of the sides, like wings or tanks or whatever it was, flying over them, just 100 yards up in the air. And it passed over them, and they could see it flying down towards the lake, and suddenly reverse 180 degrees, flying back towards them. And then they were really scared, but they thought, this will hit us. But instead of hitting them, the ghost rocket landed with a splash on the lake and started sinking. And they could see it sinking and bubbles of air coming up. And when it vanished, they really tried to get from this place as fast as they could, because they were thinking it could explode. And they went back to the car a couple of hours to the west and drove down to Stockholm, and they alerted the military, who started an investigation into this.
And did they actually go into the lake itself to see if they could find anything?
No, it's quite impossible to do that. I mean, it was a couple of hundred yards out into the lake, and it's not easy. It's a very cold water, and they were scared. And the military didn't go there either. They went there with an helicopter and looked over the lake, and they landed and tried to find what it was, but they never dived into the lake.
I see.
But we did. Yeah. We did in the 2012.
You did? Oh, in that particular lake?
Yeah, we went there together with the witnesses in 2012 and brought with us two criminal investigators from Kiruna, who also were divers, and we mapped the seafloor with the sonar, and we found some interesting spots around the spot where the witnesses had pointed out the landing, and the divers went down. But what they found was that it was 4 meters of mud, and whatever it was that had landed there, it must have sunk underneath this mud. So we went back 2 years later, 2014, with another equipment that could see through the mud. And at that point, we did see something there, resting there in the mud.
But that's as far as it went? You never dove down? Or,
yeah.
Or, is
we,
it very deep?
We couldn't do anything. It's not deep. It's only 4 yards deep and 4 yards with mud. But it's very difficult to go down into the mud. It's very dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
So we will go back again with another instrument next winter. We will be there with snowmobiles mm-hmm. on the ice. So drive this instrument that is seeing in three dimensions, and it will paint this object, and we will see if it's a reindeer, if it's a stone, or if maybe it's a ghost rocket that will give us the answer.
Ah, wow. Wow, yeah, that's really something. Let's shift gears and get back to the AFU, because you and I had a quick conversation, through email about I mentioned something about Billy Meyer's photographs selling at Sotheby's for over $20,000, which is really amazing. And what is your thought on that? I mean, how can something like that happen when, you know, most people know it's a hoax? Or I know I'm going to probably get a little bit of mail from saying that, but but most people do believe that Billy Meyer was hoaxing, even though, you know, he's handicapped and all that. But even from the 1960s, there's a lot of signs of that.
I mean, we sent an investigator to Switzerland in the late 1970s, early 1980s. I think it was the early 1980s, it must have been, to interview Billy Meyer, to investigate the case. He was elusive. He kept away from our investigator, but we were able to find other people and also find a lot of traces that show that he had manufactured his pictures, of course. But 17 of his pictures, I mean, it's prints. It's not even the negatives. It's prints sold for $24,000, which is amazing, of course. We have loads of prints from Billy Meyer at AFU. The prints that were sold at Sotheby's are not even first generation prints, some of them. So I don't know who really bought it, but we want to believe, we want to believe poster. One of those pictures are the one on the We Want to Believe poster, and that is what sold them, of course.
I see. I never. So it's pop culture thing, kind of enhancing it. Yeah.
But it's important to tell that those pictures came from the Wendell Stevens collection, and Wendell Stevens collection were scattered after his passing away, and he passed away in 2010. And we recently were able to acquire at least half of his collection, which is 1,000 kilos, 2,200 pounds, with the help of Jordan Peace from Rogue Valley Metaphysical Library in Oregon. I met with Jordan in California last summer, and we had an agreement that he sent all this stuff to Sweden and AFU. So we now have thousands and thousands and thousands of mails and not emails but letters that arrived were sent to Wendell Stevens, and also loads of material regarding the Billy Meyer case that had never been published and never been read by anyone outside the Wendell Stevens family. So we are now going through all of this and trying to sort it out and to start to scan the most important parts.
Wow, I've heard about that collection. Now, I thought, I must be mixing this up, but I thought Open Minds had purchased that collection.
No, that's right, but Open Minds sold it, and eventually it turned up at Rogue Valley in Oregon. But the other part we have also traced, and I paid a lot of money to get that to Sweden. It's a part with the photos and all the pictures. But that guy who we paid the money to hasn't sent anything to us yet, so maybe he just sits on the money and never fulfill his agreement with us. So that is a problem. We really want his full files at AFU.
Now, we have to go into break here in just a minute, but who funds these purchases for all your materials?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. It's us. We are 30 people who are putting between $5 and $100 every month into AFU. And we are also selling through AFU shop. But it's a business that costs us money to do. I don't earn a nickel from this, of course. I pay loads of money every year to keep AFU afloat. And we do, all of us. We have four people on this board. And we have a couple of guys around the world on an advisory board as well that helps us with this. But we really need more people than 30 Swedes. It's only one from outside Sweden that is helping us. But loads of people are asking for our help. So, yeah, you know, it's a difficult task, but we love to do it.
Yeah, you wouldn't do it if you didn't love it. All right. We're ready to go on a break. So this is Martin Willis. My guest tonight is Klaus Swan. And hang in there. We'll be right back right after these messages. Well, we're going to change the subject. We can jump back a little bit on what we're talking about. But as far as do you ever purchase material that is you find out later that it was hoaxed or you know, purposely hoaxed. Has that ever happened? Has anyone kind of pulled the wool or tried to pull the wool over your eyes? And
well, we very seldom purchase things at all. Those Wendell Stevens stuff are one of the few we have paid for, and we paid very little money for it. And nevertheless, if we get the hoaxed thing, and we do, we get pictures most of the time. It's part of the history. It's part of UFO history. So it doesn't really matter. We are not in it just for the real UFOs. We're in it for all of the how society looks upon this subject.
Yeah.
So we want to show everything from the lousiest, the baddest, to the brightest and the best. We save it all, really. Hoaxes and bona fide stuff.
I was talking earlier at the very beginning of the show about this. I can't remember the person's name from the 1966. And let's see, his name was Derenberger. And Woodrow Derenberger. Are you familiar with who he is? Did you?
Yeah, we have stuff from and about him. Okay, a few. Yeah, I'm not that versed into his case, I should say, but we have stuff that we have helped the researchers with copies from when they have been writing about Woodrow Derenberger. And I mean, we have so many nice things from George Adamski and first generation pictures. We have taped interviews with all those early 1950s contactees, Howard Menger and Orfeo Angelucci and all those. And those are unique. So much of what we have is unique, really. It's only one copy in the world.
Wow. How about that? It is an interesting segment, so to speak, and also very much of what he was talking about, his encounters, was a lot like what the contactees were talking about. I believe he said that he went to their planet and, on their spaceship and all that. And they looked just like us, but were a little taller or something like that. I mean, it was, that whole contactee movement is really something. And there's someone working on a film that's related to one of them that contacted me and is insistent that his great uncle or whoever it is was 100% legitimate and really did go to Venus or whatever he did. So
The stories were better in the past. I mean, 1950s, 1960s stories are still very, very interesting and very good, but maybe too good. Sometimes, at least.
Yeah. All right. Welcome back, everyone. This is Martin Willis, and my guest tonight is Klaus Swan, and all the way from Sweden. And just before we went into the break, we were talking about basically you're kind of a self-funding group, and which I find pretty amazing, and that you know, really no one would do this unless they had a passion for it. I mean, you know, I mean, someone putting in $5 a month is not too much. Someone putting in $100 is quite a bit. But also, it's just the fact that you say that you spend 2 hours, at least 2 hours a day, involved. And so you think about the time involved in, you know, chasing this stuff. You probably have countless hours in total.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And are there other people as dedicated as you to this?
We are a few. Absolutely. At AFU and also inside UFO Sweden that spent hours every day doing this. So, and that's the only way to make this move forward, really. If we don't do that, we are living under an avalanche of information coming into AFU every week. I mean, just before we started the conversation, I secured some books and papers from a newly deceased member of UFO Sweden. I got his name 5 hours ago. I wrote to his wife, his widow, and got clearance to get his paperwork and his material. And I do that all the time, really. I'm chasing so that this stuff isn't lost forever, which is this if we don't do it.
Right, right. And, you know, I talk with Dave Marler quite a bit over here, and he has, you know, quite a thing going there as well. And I think it's great that these things are, you know, are cared for, you know, to pass along to interest, you know, further on down the line. And I'm glad you're both doing that. You mentioned earlier that a lot of your books are, some of your books are in Russian, which I think is interesting. You know, I do go to Russia. I think I've talked to you before when I was over there. I don't know, like once a year or something like that. I was supposed to go this last winter, but there was a little bit of an accident. So I couldn't make it over there. I was supposed to be there right now, actually. But anyway, in 1993, you went to Moscow. And let's talk about that. There was some type of dramatic situation happened.
Well, yeah, we went to Moscow, me and a Russian-speaking friend, at AFU, in October 1993. And what we didn't know at that time, that when we landed, we were the last taxi from the airport. After us, tanks were rolling on the same street, and the shooting were starting at the parliament, because the parliament were under siege for a couple of days. So it was gunshots in the streets, and they were shooting with those tanks on the parliament. So it was on fire, and I was standing there looking at this, because I mean, I'm a journalist, I'm working with the largest morning newspaper in Sweden, and I had to work, of course, when I came there, and all this shooting started. It was quite surrealistic, really, and we were there trying to secure contacts with Russian ufologists, and we did that. But at one point we went to the Star City, where the cosmonauts are living, and it was shooting there, so we couldn't go there. We had to go there the next day when the shooting had stopped. So eventually we secured 1,100 original reports from a Russian who came to us with them, and also we copied the KGB UFO files when we were there. So it was quite a good trip eventually, and quite dramatic, absolutely.
Wow, you could actually get into the KGB files?
Yeah, we had a friend who went there for us and brought the copies back. He was an editor for a Russian rocket and aircraft magazine, and he helped us with that. And you know about Russians, they drink all the time, and he was also drinking all the time. He treated us with vodka at 12 o'clock, and we were drunk in 2 hours, so we thought we cannot do this anymore. It was impossible to work for us. So the next time I met with him, I brought beer with me, which I can handle. And I said, well, we have our own drinks here, so I think I will go with the beer. So I drank a beer and felt fine for the rest of the day.
Well, the doctors, I'm not joking when I say this, at least some doctors are over in Russia actually tell their patients to drink vodka. It'll help you, you know, clear your arteries, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. The average lifespan is, 56 or 57 or something like that.
That's pretty sad. That's right. Now, there was a strange incident in a park with these really tall, beings that came out of a craft in Russia. Do you remember that story? Have you ever heard about that one?
Yeah, Jacques Vallée wrote about it in his book about Russian UFO encounters, and there have been, I don't remember the city's name, I should do that, of course.
Yeah. But it wasn't that long ago, it was in the 1990s, I think, right?
Voronezh.
Oh, that's right,
Yeah, I mean, there's so many stories like that in Russia, stories about robotic-like creatures. If you read the KGB files as well, you can see that, maybe 50% are misinterpretations of their own rocket launches, but there are also cases that are very, very strange. So Russia is a very interesting country. You should do more research there. It's very hard to do that, but you should do that.
Yes, I tried to connect with people when I was there, and I could not get very far. Unfortunately, I was only in Moscow for a short time, but I was in, mostly on the Black Sea in a place called Novorossiysk, which is across from Turkey. But there was a little bit of UFO activity and people talking about it there, but not, it was kind of a handful. So I wanted to, again, switch gears and talk about your book. I'm going to bring that up in the thing one more time if I can. And so I do love this book, I have to say. And can you talk about how you put that together and some of the images that are actually in here?
Yeah, I had a plan doing this for several years, but my publisher wasn't that interested. I publish the book every year. I've written nearly 30 books by now.
Wow.
But this book, I really wanted to write this one, so I tried to get him interested in this. But eventually he said, okay. So he printed, it's a large publishing company. They printed a Swedish edition, 6,500 copies, which is a small edition for me. But we, AFU, got funds from a guy in the U.S. who sometimes helps us. He gave us $10,000 so we could print this English edition. So I started writing in January and I stopped writing in May last year. And all the pictures were taken by a friend of my professional photographer. I brought everything that is in the book down to my old hometown, and we spent a full day taking Hasselblad pictures, high-resolution pictures of everything that I was interested of carrying in the book.
And how long did it take you to find all these images? Did you go a lot of them from your, or all of them from your archives?
Yeah. All of them are from AFU. All of them are pictures that we have or have the rights to use. It took quite a while to assemble all of those stuff. It's not only pictures, it's toys, it's posters, it's records.
Yeah. And you have also memorabilia there as well, right? Besides books.
Lots of it. We try to save the history of UFOs, and that it's not only paperworks, it's also memorabilia, like I said, posters when Adamski or Lord Dowding or any other prominent 1950s or 60s ufologist or contactee have given a lecture. We are trying to trace posters and save them. We save very, very nice 1950s toys with flying saucers. They are worth hundreds of dollars each.
Oh, yeah.
And we have so many things that are, as I said before, unique in the world and very, very hard to find. Stamps. We collect UFO stamps. And there are a couple of ufologists around the world that do that. So we exchange stamps from time to time.
Wow. That's amazing. I never would have thought of stamps. that they're actually on stamps. How about that? And as far as you know, I mean, like you just mentioned, I know these toys can get like crazy. There's you know, vintage toy collectors, you know, what they call like new in the box, that type of thing. They can go for thousands of dollars sometimes. Do you ever have people donate things to you?
Most of the things we have are donated to us. I mean, we don't buy that much. So we're trying to find. I travel to England or Great Britain, I should say, every year. I've done 21 trips since 2000. And I will do another one in April. And I save stuff from attics, from basements, from rooms in houses there, where the it's crammed. Some of the houses we are entering are crammed with stuff, and the wives are very happy when we are coming and bringing all that stuff back to Sweden instead. So yes, all of that are donated to us. We don't pay anything for it. For transport, we do pay.
Yeah. I was in a house, prominent family down in Massachusetts recently, and I looked up on top of their. I was doing an appraisal of their fine art and antiques and everything in their house, and I looked up on their kitchen counter, and there was a big jar up there with an alien in it. And I just started laughing. I said, "What's that?" And they said that their uncle or whatever has a sense of humor and sent it to them. So, but yeah, it looked actually kind of real and kind of scary.
So it wasn't real.
Oh, no, it wasn't. No, but I mean, they try to make it look real. Why do you call the AFU a Fortean archive?
Well, Fortean means really it's from Charles Fort. I mean, he was the author of four books in the early 1900s. He was the father of all those subjects that we are collecting. He was an American writer. He lived between 1874 and 1932. And he collected what he called damned facts. Hmm. That is, facts that were damned by the scientists, not interesting. He was pouring through those scientific journals, trying to pick the gems, and he did. He found hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of UFO observations or paranormal events. I mean, everything you could think of. And after him, those subjects, UFOs, ghosts, the paranormal, everything that is strange, is called Fortean. We have Fortean Times, which is a magazine still published in London, which is a fantastic magazine. It is a must read for ufologists, of course. So that is why we call AFU a Fortean library and a Fortean archive.
I see. I've never I've heard that term a number of times, but I never really quite understood it. So thank you for clearing that up. What other things does the UFO Sweden do besides the AFU?
Well, UFO Sweden is an ordinary UFO society like MUFON in the US. We have members. We print two magazines, which circulated in 1,200 copies, the glossy one. And we have field investigators training courses every year. We had one in October where 55 people paid $250 to spend a weekend together with me and my friends in UFO Sweden, that when we are trying to learn them how to investigate UFO reports. And that we have done now since the middle of the 1970s every year. And that is also something that very, very few UFO groups do.
Wow.
So that is very hugely important for us to let those newcomers know what people can misinterpret in the skies, because you must sift through all of that before getting down to the real UFOs. It's a hard work, but it's very, very interesting, of course.
So you actually had 55 people show up. Isn't that's quite a few people for a training And is that throughout Sweden or what?
Yeah, throughout Sweden and also from Norway. They always send people from Norway to our courses.
Hmm. And can anybody take, are your courses in your language only?
Yeah, I'm sorry to say it's a Swedish language course. And we have been thinking of maybe taking this to other countries because what we do is very high quality. And it's something that we should export, really, or maybe do online or something. But you need to be there because we have those encounters when our field investigators are encountering a UFO that we create for them. And we do it without their knowledge. Ah. And they have to report and tell what they have seen. So it's a play, really. We play with them. And it's very, very interesting because after they have done this, they say, I never trust anyone after this. Because they cannot really estimate the distance. They cannot really tell what they saw. They cannot make a drawing that is looking like the object because that is the circumstances that real UFO witnesses are exposed to. So it's very, very good to be exposed to that yourself.
I see. I know that the Arizona MUFON does like a training course every year. I had some people on from that, and I think that's really great because, you know, a lot of times also people can decide, well, maybe it's not for me too at the same time. You know, maybe they're expecting something else. But
But they know nowadays, they know what we do, and nobody is really expecting anything else. But of course, not everyone will be a field investigator after this.
Yeah.
Most of them are just interested, you know, and will stay out in the perimeter of the organization. But maybe 10 people every year, if we are lucky, we can have as field investigators and keep them.
Mm. Wow, that's not bad, really. Now, since you and I have last talked. And I would want to get your opinion as someone outside of our country. What is your opinion, as I was talking about in the monologue in the beginning, it seems like the Navy has really been outspoken about the UFO topic. And what does someone like you think about that?
I mean, we are in contact with To the Stars Academy quite a lot. And I also talked for a long time with Luis Elizondo, who is one of the main characters, of course, in TTSA. We also had one of them from TTSA over in Sweden visiting AFU. So we are trying to work together with them. And, of course, they were the ones that brought those film clips out in the open. And, I mean, the U.S. Navy, what they have done now, they have told their pilots to report what they see in the sky. They are telling that this is something they take seriously. And both of that, those things have been told before. I mean, we are back in the 1950s or 60s again, but not for a while. So, and that is very good. It helps us. It helps everyone that is interested in UFOs all over the world because it makes our interest and topic more mainstream in many ways. So I think it's very, very good for us. Whatever comes out of this, we have so many good things coming out of it already.
Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people that speculate that, you know, To the Stars has an agenda. Some people think they do. Some people think they don't. How do you see them, you know, personally? How do you feel? Do you think they're... It seems to me they're moving the needle, you know, regardless. Things happen.
I mean, they're trying to assemble information so they can maybe build a craft. That's what they have been telling. They really want to make the most of those fragments that may have been found from UFOs. So I wish them good luck with that. I think it's a very, very hard thing to do. It's very problematic in many, many respects. But, of course, they have an agenda. All of us has some kind of agenda. we want to go somewhere. I mean, for myself, I want to help people with information. That's my agenda. And I want to know what UFOs are, of course. I don't have that insight, so I know if they're having a hidden agenda. But
I
cannot really comment on that.
Right, right. You know, do you think that we'll ever know what UFOs are?
You know, when I started in 1974, I knew much less than I know today. I know very, very more about misinterpretations, what people can misinterpret in the sky. I also know that there are some very, very tough UFO cases that are very hard to crack, that are really nearly unbelievable when you listen to the observers. No, I'm not sure I will live to get the answer, but who knows? I may be old.
Yeah, it's still. I feel probably about the same way. You know, more or less the same way. But in Sweden, it seems like more or less people take this seriously. And you're on TV quite a bit for representing, as the guy. Yep. You're the UFO guy of Sweden, basically. Anytime there's a TV show on, right? I mean, they call you and bring you in. And what about science there? You know, the science community, have any Swedish science looked into this topic seriously?
Well, not really. I mean, we have very good contacts with astronomers and physicists and psychologists. We have a couple of those on the board that helps us with the difficult cases. They evaluate our work and looks at the cases that we found most interesting. But there have not been any research into UFOs in Sweden. I'm sorry to say, but it's a very difficult topic, of course. It's hard to investigate. But when you say that people here in Sweden are interested and open about it, that is true, because we knocked the doors during a couple of years. We talked with 1,600 Swedes, and out of the 1,600 Swedes, 10% of them had seen something in the sky that they couldn't really understand, and most of them had never told it to anyone outside their own family. So it's 1 million Swedes. I mean, we are 10 million in Sweden. 1 million Swedes can be, I mean, holding back their very, very interesting observations that we will never know about. We had 20,000 observations in UFO Sweden's files. That's nothing if there is 1 million out there that don't talk about them.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I think about, too, is, are there really that many UFOs actually flying around Earth? And if so, you know, are they all from different places? Where are they from? And if they are from another planet, you know, I mean, who knows for, you know, where they're from. But still, there's so many sightings. It's just, it's unbelievable if you really think about it.
Yeah, but to be honest, most of them are misinterpretations of mundane objects. If we give every sighting the time it deserves, we usually find an explanation to it. I mean, real UFOs are scarce. We may get one or two every year here in Sweden, if we are lucky. And not every year there is one. But the ones that are left that have really physical impact on maybe a car or something else, they are the most interesting, of course. But they are not that many that people would tend to believe. We get 250 reports every year. Only a handful are interesting enough to really go more in more detail about.
Yeah, sure. All right, well, we're ready to go into break. So this is Martin Willis. My guest tonight is Klaus Vaughn, and we'll be right back right after these messages. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back. My guest tonight is Klaus Vaughn from Sweden, and we are talking UFOs and documents and books and archives and all kinds of interesting things in the UFO world. You saved like a bunch of stuff in California that was in a garage or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the oldest UFO groups in the world, called Borderland Science Research Association. And we had tried for years to get in contact with the person who was in charge of this 1940s organization.
Wow.
We called him, we wrote to him, we emailed him, we tried every way we could, but he never answered us. But suddenly one night at 2 o'clock in the night, I called him, and he picked up the phone. And after that, he was hooked. And I met with him and a couple of years ago, 2016. I went to California together with my family on holiday. And then we met and we packed all of this stuff, this wonderful stuff from the garage, which he had saved for decades, moving with him. And we sent that to Sweden. And now it's sorted. We have scanned a lot of it. We have helped him with scannings. We have got things back from us. We do that. We try to help people with getting things back as well, of course. And, I mean, it's from 1940s up till the 1990s. And it's fantastic. It's letters and reports and newspaper clippings and loads of stuff.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. And when you ship something like that, how do you ship it? I mean, it's so expensive to ship international.
It is. When we shipped this huge collection from Oregon, this 1,000 kilos, it costs around $1,500.
Oh, it's less than I thought. Well.
Yeah. But it comes customs and other stuff as well. So it eventually maybe $2,000 tops. So, well, yeah. We can do it, but it's not for free, no.
Yeah. And you're traveling all over the place. Can you talk about some of the other places you've traveled to find things?
Yeah, I'm traveling a lot to Europe, northern parts of Europe mainly. But Britain is my main traveling focus, because in the 1950s, there were so many UFO groups in Britain. And all of them had exchanged with all over the world. They got the magazines from Japan, from the US. They had letters from ufologists and contactees all over the world. So you can find nearly anything you want when it comes to the early history of UFOs in Britain. And, I mean, Gordon Creighton, who was the publisher of Flying Saucer Review for many, many years. I met with him in 2001, I think, the first time. When he passed away a couple of years later, I was the first to enter his house. And his son had told me that, do not go up to the second floor. So I went there, of course, the first I did. And we couldn't even open the door. It was so crammed with stuff. We spent maybe 20 minutes trying to get in. And we did that. The whole room was filled with paperwork, with books, with reports, with all stuff from 50 years of ufology, from UFO work. And eventually we found a staircase. We didn't see it. After an hour, we found it, because it was underneath books. And we went up to another floor where we found a library. And eventually it took us 10 years to get all of this to Sweden, because they didn't want to part with it. But I went there 10 times talking to the guy who took care of this, and eventually he said, take it. So now we have it ordered and scanned some of it, but we are going to scan much more of it. It's a hugely important archive. The Flying Saucer Review was the most important magazine for many, many, many years.
Wow. And when you scan these things, do you ever put them up on your website where people can actually, you know, get to some of this material?
Well, we have a server where we put everything on. It's not that easy just to publish anything and everything. It's very personal.
I see, yeah.
Sometimes you must redact witnesses' names and things like that. So even though we have scanned all of the British UFO Research Association's files, which I found during 20 years of travels in maybe 25 or 30 different places around Britain, we have scanned all of it and given it back in a scanned format to Bufora. We cannot publish it because it's very sensitive, and they must make the decision what they want to make public in that way. But we do make public all of those magazines that we have cleared the copyright issues for. So then you can go and get them for free from AFU download. And we help people. Of course, if you are coming to us, you can see everything we have. But the sensitive material, you may not be able to copy everything. You must maybe delete names if you are going to bring it with you.
I see. Now, about copyright, that's one of the things I thought of when I received your book in the mail and I was looking, you know, through it. How difficult is it to find out, first of all, if an image has a copyright, and then how do you get around that if you want to publish it?
Yeah, it's difficult. You really have to. There is many countries have the 50-year span that you can make available pictures that are more than 50 years after the person who took it has passed away. When it comes to magazine, it's much more easy. We can trace, and we have help with a guy in Britain who helps us to trace people all around the world that keeps copyrights. But we must really be thorough in this, so we don't step over a line. Mm-hmm. And if some people say that this picture you cannot publish, we don't do it.
Right. Yes. I actually, by error, once I had a Billy Meyer picture in one of my blogs, and I was contacted, you know, to take the image down, you know, which is fine. I'll be glad to do that whenever I'm contacted. No problem at all. But, wow, interesting. And getting back to that, you know, you talked about the enormous amount of money those pictures brought. Do you think that is going to set a trend for people buying, you know, UFO pictures? Or do you think that was a one-time thing because of the picture being on that poster?
I'm a little scared about this. Could set some sort of bottom line for how that everything is really worth something. And of course, UFOs are not only for ufologists. It's something that is in the public mind after so many sci-fi movies and all the documentaries and X-Files and all that stuff. People are ready to pay for it. They are. We have material worth millions, of course, at AFU, if we were going to sell it. And I really hope that it's not the case that we must buy stuff for loads of money. There is, of course, a risk. It is a risk.
Right. Now, getting back to what the research that you do over there, can you talk about some of the case files that have happened? Maybe since you last been on the show, anything interesting?
Yeah, we have this case file from it's a British policeman, Alan Godfrey. He was working in Todmorden, which is outside Manchester, north of Manchester, in 1980. And his case file also contains his uniform. We do have his uniform, his jacket, that he may have had on himself when he was abducted on this craft he met on November the 28th. He was out looking for cows. It was a herd of cows that had been vanishing from a farmer nearby, and he was out looking for them. But early in the morning, it was, I think, 4:45 or something like that, he was traveling on this road outside Todmorden when a huge craft suddenly hanged in the air in front of his police car, so he stopped. he didn't have any camera with him, so he stopped and just looked at it. It was like whirling. It was moving very swiftly. So leaves and branches were traveling around it like in a whirlstorm. Hmm. And he started to write, to draw the object instead. He took some paper and started to draw it. And suddenly it was a flash of light. And he felt himself being driving the car on the other side of the object. I mean, the second before he was standing, sitting in the car, drawing. And after that, suddenly he was driving again from the object. And he turned around, he turned the vehicle around, and the object was gone. But he could see it was a pattern of a dry area on the way, on the road, because it had been raining. But where the object had been seen, it was an area that was really dry. And after that, he had five different hypnosis sessions, and he told the same story in every one of them, that he suddenly were taken out of the car on board the ship, meeting tall alien or whatever it was. He never said it was an alien, and some other guys there as well. And after that, he didn't tell anymore. He couldn't go past that point. He stopped there every time. And his police jacket, we have at AFU, and we have his story and his report.
Wow, that's a great one. And I do remember clearly that you said the abduction thing is very, very low in Sweden, that you get, it's very rare that you get any reports about that. Is that about the same as it always was, besides this story?
Yeah, it is. It's very, very uncommon. But that said, just a couple of months ago, I met a guy who regularly, every night or every second night, and you can make of it whatever you want, travels to other planets. And he's a part of this huge collection of entities that are ruling the universe. I mean, it sounds crazy, but the guy is not crazy. I mean, he got a proper job and an important job as well. And he's really, really much like you and me when he tells this story. But his story is, of course, so strange that it's very, very hard to believe. And I know several other people here in Sweden that tells the same kind of stories, that they travel nighttime to different planets and meet entities and discuss things with them. And sometimes they bring stuff back with them as well. So, yeah, what do you know? I mean, it's very hard to investigate, but that kind of stories you can find here as well.
Yeah, wow. Wow, I'm actually surprised after our other conversations, because I remember you told me, I think there was only a couple of cases that you were aware of, and one of them was actually really interesting, where it was actually a police officer as well. His wife was lifted off the bed or something in front of him.
Oh yeah, it was not a police officer, but that's right. You're remembering right. He was in his bed and he was sleeping, and his wife was sleeping beside him. And I met with both of them in their home. And his wife told me that she was always waking up as she had fell asleep. She was sleeping very, very sound, very deep, never woke up. But this night she woke and there was a greenish light in the bedroom. She was like hovering over the bed in the fetus position with her face down to the bed, and she saw her husband sleeping, and she was dragged out from the bed, and she was scared, of course, so she tried to shout and wake up her husband, but she couldn't shout, so she instead grabbed him by his arm. And he tells me that he wakes feeling this grabbing of his arm, and he sees his wife floating out from the bed towards three entities, very much like the ones you see on Whitney Strieber's communion cover, that were standing at the end of the bed, and she was drawn to them. And he thought, what should I do? And he did one thing very strange, of course. He tried to kick them. So when he did that, he tried to kick them. Suddenly, everything went dark, and he heard a pounce like somebody falling. And his wife was, of course, outside the bed at that time, and she fell to the floor.
Ooh.
And if you think that is strange, what is happening next is much more strange to me, because she crawls up into the bed, and they were talking to each other, and she says, "What do you think that was?" And he says, "I have no idea," and they fell asleep again.
They fell asleep again. And
yeah.
That is something I've heard on this show. A lot of times people have this major thing happen, a major sighting, and they go right to sleep.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that doesn't seem like that it makes any sense. But
stranger than the story, really.
Yeah, yeah. That is bizarre. Yeah, that's really something. But as far as the abductions go, and or the experiencers and stuff like that, generally speaking, it's very low. You get very few reports.
Yeah, absolutely.
Overall, out of the 250 reports that you look into, is there a portion that are people claiming that they were also abducted?
No, not really. Maybe entities. I mean, they were very common in the 1970s. When I started as a young ufologist, you could meet people that had met entities. Nowadays, you can do that, but that's very, very, very seldom. We don't get that kind of report very often. Maybe once a year, maybe every second year, something like that.
I see. Hmm. And as far as the reports are they a similar type of objects that people are seeing? You know, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of triangle UFOs. A lot of people are talking about them. Is that common over there as well?
No, triangle observations are very, very seldom as well here. We do get a few, and we have been able to identify many of them as aircraft. But there are some very strange triangular observations, of course, here as well. But most of the pictures we get, most of the observations we get are nighttime specks of light.
Mm.
That really, really does say nothing at all. They are not informative, I should say. I mean, you would think that people with those mobile cameras would take loads of very, very good pictures now, but they don't.
Yeah.
You don't have those fantastic UFO pictures anymore as you had in the 1950s when, well, the contactees took pictures all the time.
Why do you suppose that is? I mean, everyone has a cell phone on them, almost.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, here in Sweden, everyone got one. I mean, it's hard to find anyone who doesn't. I mean, that tells me that the real UFOs are very, very scarce again. And most of the things you see can be explained. It's hard to say that, because if you say that, people think you're a skeptic or something. But I'm not a skeptic. I'm skeptical in when it comes to people's interpretations of what they have seen. But I am open to it can be anything and everything. And you must be both ways. It's mm-hmm. very important. So, of course, there are pictures that are better, but I'm still waiting for the really good ones, at least here in Sweden.
Yes, yes. I'm opening up the phone lines if anyone would like to call in and ask our guest a question. And that number is 855-472-5483. It's up on the YouTube screen. You can see that now if you'd like to call in. And it's really quite amazing when you think about, as far as all the reports go. What, and how would you? I know you're very particular on how you would report a UFO. Can you give advice to maybe a listener out there who may encounter in the future a UFO? What they should do once they see one?
The first thing you should do is to take a picture, not because of the picture may be of great quality, but because the camera gives us the time of the observation.
Ah, mm-hmm.
So whatever you see, if it's a speck of light far away, take a picture. And after that, we can, of course, check what was in the air or in the sky at that time. And after that, you should try to record what you are seeing. Maybe film it, maybe talk to your telephone if you have one, or write it down as soon as possible. If you are in a familiar area, try to see in which direction you saw this. Most people don't have a clue about north and south, even though if they have lived in an area for many years, they often mistake north and south or east and west. So it's very, very good to know where you are, when it was, and what you thought you saw. Those three things are the crucial questions you always ask as a researcher afterwards.
And I remember you talking about you and your wife actually witnessed something coming home one night. So if it's like a multiple witness situation, what would you explain to them that you do a little bit different than what you just said?
Yeah, what we did at that time was that we were not talking to each other. We were separating each other in two different rooms in our house. It was in the middle of the night. Sat down with a form that UFO Sweden uses, and I mean UFO and other groups have those report forms as well. And we answered all the questions. We made the drawings, and after that, we compared notes and talked. So it's very important when you are in a group not to let the group leader, because they're always a leader in any group, affect you. Mm-hmm. And tell you what you are seeing. I've seen so many UFO reports with groups seeing things that are getting really looking that everyone tells the same story eventually. And that is not the case, because people don't see or remember things the same way as the other guy do.
Yeah. I think the most important takeaway that anybody can get from this is you do something right away, as quick as you can, and document it as much as you can.
And if you don't have a cell phone, look at your watch, and time is essential. If we have a UFO report and we don't know when it happened, it can never be the solution can never be a UFO afterwards. That case can never be solved, and we can never say that it was a UFO sighting, even though it may have been a fantastic sighting. That's the rules we have in UFO Sweden. We need to have exact time so we can check what kind of misinterpretations it could have been. If we cannot check it, we cannot call it a UFO.
Two or three weeks ago, there was a UFO video up on YouTube and looked darn good, actually. I've never followed up on it in the last few weeks, but the person that posted the video said over 100 witnesses and blah blah blah, and then showed this video. So I wrote in the comments below, okay, well, where are those 100 witnesses, and where are the other films? It's okay for someone to say there's 100 witnesses, but if that's all you got, it's not much of a leg to stand on. You need more documentation than just putting it under the video. So
to me, YouTube is entertainment, and yeah. It's not really something you report UFOs through, but you entertain other people.
I do believe that a lot of people don't know what to do, and when they see something unusual, they put it on YouTube totally because they don't know what to do. I believe that is true. But there is the entertainment aspect, and the amount of views that the hoaxers get is I almost dare say criminal in a way. Some of the CGI things that are out there that look so good, and it's just a shame. Because
it's very, very hard today to tell really what is a bona fide film or just a hoax.
Yeah,
we have our experts in UFO Sweden that are quite skilled, but it's very, very hard to tell a hoax if you have film something real. I mean, if you have thrown something up in the air, which is a real thing, and film that, I mean, it's real.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to tell what it could be. I mean, it comes down to interviewing the witness, to meeting the witness on the spot where this thing happened. And when we do that, many times we get the solution there, because most witnesses, they don't follow through with our hoax stories when we are there trying to really get them to explain. They can't really get their story through at that time.
Again, the phone lines are open at 855-472-5483. You know, what do you think that you would consider the all-out evidence that someone could gather? You know, I mean, a crashed UFO? I mean, you know, I mean,
that's what it is.
It's a lot of the reason why a lot of people won't take this seriously is because, you know, it's a something fleeting, you know, and then we're going to get to the point where we're not going to be able to believe, you know, images or video any longer. And what do you do then, you know?
I think we haven't really gone forward. We have been going backwards because of the technicalities and the problems with the films and the hoaxing and what you can do with your film camera today. So it comes down to that you must find something and a piece of something, really. And from that, see something completely new that we didn't know before. Because witnesses are very, very interesting, but they don't prove anything else than that we have something to investigate. And that we know. We do have some really, really interesting things to investigate. I mean, I met with Swedish fighter pilots who have tried to chase those things in the sky. They've seen them on radar. And, of course, we have their stories, but we don't have their radar recordings. That is a problem. And we really need all those pieces to get past UFOs just being very, very strange stories to be something that science could really get their hands on.
Right. You mentioned earlier about TTSA and their metamaterials or whatever it is they think that they have there. And I know there was this situation with Arts Parts. I don't know if you ever heard of those. Art Bell. I think Linda Moulton Howe had something to do with it as well, as these parts were supposedly from a crash saucer, and part of the material ended up being radiator foil. I don't know about the rest of it and if that's what TTSA has or they have more. I don't really know, but
well, radiator foil is not very strange, is it?
Yeah, I mean, but this was I think in the 90s when Art Bell received these things. I'm not sure exactly when, but it's pretty much you know, that's pretty much documented. That's what part of that stuff is, and it was all found in one area. So maybe there's something else in there that's good. Has anyone ever tried to give your organization anything like that they're saying had something to do with trace evidence or crash saucer or anything like that?
Well, we do have a couple of things, that are strange, at least, or strange looking, I should say. One of them are from the late 1950s. It was a couple of carpenters that were driving a car outside Stockholm, northeast of Stockholm, when they saw this object coming down from the sky, and their car stalled, and they were standing there looking at this object hanging in front of them. And suddenly the object went away and the car started, but the guys went out to take a look at the spot where the object had been positioned, and they found this metal. It's a tungsten metal. And they picked it up. It was all hot. It was the middle of the night. It was very, very hot, so it really showed that something had heated it. And tungsten is not keeping warmth very, very low, so it should have been cold. And that has been analyzed many, many times in the US and in Europe, and I also put it through an analysis here in Sweden, and it showed to be a very mundane object. It was a tungsten object, but it was made with the same problems which they had in the 1950s. It was the impurities in the metal that were in the 1950s, so it was not alien in any way, but it showed that something had happened, because the warmth of it showed that the object had really been there. Something had been there and stopped the car. That's one of the objects we have. We have another object from the 1950s as well. Sorry, from the 1930s as well, that fell from the sky from an object that was seen in broad daylight. And that is not containing any strange metal or anything else as well. But the story is very strange. It fell from this glowing globe of light and was picked up by a farmer. But that's the only two objects we do have, to tell you a few.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. I mean, you see a lot of these UFOs that are dropping something, you know, or dripping or whatever, you know. That's really, yeah. It really is quite bizarre. Sorry, caller, our call screener didn't pick you up. Please do try calling back. Yeah, I mean, you hear about like how Charles Hult, you know, in Rendlesham Forest said, you know, he went and tried to figure out what he saw that was dripping off of, you know, the yeah. object that he saw bouncing through the trees, and they couldn't, you know, couldn't really find anything. So anyway, our caller did call back. And we have Steve on the line from Las Vegas. Welcome to the show, Steve. You got a question for our guest? Steve, are you there? Says he's on air. Hello, Steve, you there? I don't hear him. Do you hear him, Klaus?
No.
No, it's showing everything looks good on this end. I'm not sure what's going on. Okay. Put him back on hold. And, well, I don't know if there's a problem with this system. I'll try it again. Steve, can you hear us? Looks like I can see the see that he's talking, but we are not hearing anything on this end. So it looks like we might have an issue.
Okay, I'll try again. I'll try.
Oh, there you are, Steve. Yes, hi.
Yes. Oh, hi. So,
okay.
Oh, we got back there. Hello, gentlemen. Yes, I have a question. I work night, so I just kind of missed a little of the show. I'm not sure if you covered the topic on the subject on the, my question, but my question to you, sir, is everything that's been happening in the past few years, 2 years in ufology in the U.S., started with the military offering new guidelines to pilots and opening up a little bit for the reports. And then comes, as you know, the Nimitz incident, and everything that's been going on in the U.S. the past couple years, what's your go on that? I mean, why do you think the government's opening it up, and where do you think ufology's going here in the U.S.?
Oh, thank you for the question, Steve. It's a very interesting couple of years, the last couple of years, of course, because of what's happened in the United States. And the films from those U.S. Navy pilots are, of course, shown all over the world. And I think the most important thing coming out of this is that this topic is taken more and more serious. I've watched so many U.S. TV shows now and news casts as well, that the anchors and all the people involved are taking this serious now. So whatever comes from this, it's really done something good from that. If you're ever going to know what the Nimitz guys did see, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the Navy knows either. I think they're as baffled as we are, really. And I hope that we can get some more information out from the Navy, their their research. I mean, they have done investigations into this that we have not seen yet, and they have said that they will not show, but hopefully someday they will show that, and then we will know more about it.
Thank you so much. I want question. Do you think disclosure could happen in the U.S. in any way or around the world from another country or anything?
Yeah, it means it really, I think that disclosure has happened in many countries already, because there are governments, I mean, there are at least military that have gone on record saying that there are things that they don't know what it is. But if you mean that they are going to tell that we are visited or we know what those UFOs are, I'm not sure, because I don't sure that they know either. I think they are as baffled as we are. So I'm not waiting for any disclosure yet. Hopefully we will get to know more from the governments. I think they know more than we, but they don't know the answer to the question.
All right. Hey, Steve, thanks for the call.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. And thank you for both of your hard work in ufology. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks a lot. As far as the Nimitz in that whole case, that is baffling. I think that's probably or could be the one of the biggest cases. You know, it definitely has been for many, many years one of the bigger cases. Because of the witnesses, the quality of the witnesses, the military involved, and all that. And then the Navy actually changing a few policies based around that.
And there's one very interesting thing within the Nimitz observations, that during those days of those observations, several witnesses were telling about those objects coming down very fast from very high, 20,000-30,000 feet or something like that, more, and coming down to the sea and maybe going up again very fast. And I have seen the same here in Sweden when I interviewed a pilot who in 1977 chased one of those objects out in the Baltic area, because he told me that when he approached the object, it suddenly started to climb, and he was trying to get closer to it, but he was outflown by it, and the object vanished suddenly around, I think it was at least 40,000 meters or something like that. He couldn't see it anymore on his radar screen. It was traveling right out into space, as he told me. Wow. And the same thing you saw in the Nimitz stories, really, the objects moving like that, like dropping and going up very, very fast.
Do we have as far as you know, I mean, I don't know what government or all governments have any type of scanning, you know, satellites up, you know, high in the altitude where, you know, if objects were coming in from, say, you know, out in the solar system somewhere, that we'd actually be able to detect them? It seems like we would have that capability. And if so,
I mean, there are satellites up there that can see bolides coming in from outer space and going into the atmosphere. I mean, large meteors.
Mm-hmm.
That we know that, and things like that are published from time to time. And the most many of the U.S. Spy satellites can see things like that as well. So. They could probably see other objects as well if they are coming in from outside the atmosphere and going into Earth.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering if there was anything like that happening during the Nimitz encounters, if there was any type of documentation, you know, because it would seem like the Navy would have access to that if they were really investigating this thing.
Well, I think most of the American spy satellites are not over the U.S. territory. I mean, they are looking for something else.
Oh, that's true.
So,
yeah.
So the best pictures are probably not there. They are over North Korea, Iran, or whatever.
Right. I get that. You're probably right. And as far as the Nimitz case in particular, I know there was this guy that was claiming to be in the Air Force intelligence and saying that the Air Force was actually trying to see what the Navy would come up with their, you know, secret craft, that drones or whatever was there flying. I don't know if you followed any of that. I didn't buy it. I don't know what has happened in the last few weeks as far as that whole thing goes. But have you heard anything about that? He was claiming the Air Force.
These were Air Force. Heard about it, but I'm a little skeptical about that as well as you are. What I think is interesting is that U.S. Air Force has not came up with new roles as the U.S. Navy. They have been quite...
Exactly.
They're doing something else. I mean, I don't know why, because U.S. Air Force should say something in this as well. You would think, at least.
Yeah, I mean, they're the protectors of our skies here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the two different entities of your army that give quite mixed positions.
Yeah. It a lot of that doesn't make any sense. And like I said in the beginning, it's almost as baffling as the UFO topic, you know, in general.
You know. Yeah.
But it does seem promising to me anyway.
Yeah, to me as well. Absolutely.
Yeah. And as far as when you do a talk and a lecture and you have, you know, people ask questions at the end, I'm sure that's probably what happens there, I would assume. Mm. What do you say when someone says, well, are they aliens or something like that? What do you say? How do you answer that?
I'm telling them that we don't know that. I mean, we have so many reports of entities, other entities, as well. If you look through the history, you've got so many folklore entities that were taken for granted just maybe 150 years back or 100 years back. They were more reported than today's aliens. I don't really see any distinction between the folklore entities and the aliens. I think they could have the same answer at the end. It could be something to do with ourselves. It could be some physical part of it as well. I mean, I get today reports of gnomes here in Sweden and elves. And I mean,
really?
Yeah.
And so they actually contact your organization for something like that?
I mean, I've written so many books and people read my books and they know I'm interested in all of this. So they write to me and call me. Yeah, so I get many, many stories about meetings with entities of different kinds. I mean, I went to a church here in Sweden and where people met the Virgin Mary. And I had seen her for a couple of days. So I went there. It was a huge mass, 2,000 people attending. And suddenly people started to see Virgin Mary outside the window. And they were taking pictures and everyone were leaning out trying to see her. And I was there. I didn't see anything. But afterwards people were telling me what they have seen. And they really had seen something that they thought were a real person, the Virgin. So, it's hard to tell when people are telling you stories what really happened.
Wow, interesting. Looks like we have a caller from your neck of the woods, Patrick Johnson from Sweden. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Hello, Klaus Vaughn.
Hello, Patrick.
I'm a member of your group, UFO Sweden.
Nice. Yes.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Hey, thanks for calling in.
Yeah. Thank you. I was, for about 1 year ago, I was going outside Kristianstad in Sweden, south of Sweden. And I was going out late at the night, absolutely. And I remember I was sending this info to UFO Sweden, to Klaus Vaughn. And it was IIS, you know, the International Space Station. I could see that when they investigated. Yeah, maybe you remember it, Klaus. I don't know.
I do. I remember that.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. But the thing I thought was so amazing, it was when it was disappearing, something came back, and then I just saw something, a light, going back when the IIS was vanishing from the sky. Something came back, and then it's just poof, right up in the sky, in an amazing speed.
So it followed the same trajectory. It followed the same trajectory backwards.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Just slightly behind it, actually, towards the left a little bit. And it was so amazing. And I did call it. It was late at the night, and I did call my brother and woke him up and just said, I saw a UFO, because you say UFO because I couldn't say it was a flying saucer. I couldn't say that because it was an identical flying object, and it was amazing. And I know those kind of strange things, because since 2001 I have driven a site called the Spokeweb, or called Ghost Web in English. Investigating paranormal activities. So I have captured things since 2001, and I have things captured in videos. So I know I saw this, and it was amazing.
What you're telling me is very interesting. I mean, it's very hard to tell, of course, what it could have been, but I mean, I understand that you really... remember this, because it was so strange.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling me the story. I appreciate it.
I have to tell a story.
Yeah. No problem.
I thought I was seeing the International Space Station too one night. I was out several years ago. I lived on a golf course, and I was out on the golf course at night, and I was looking up. I was walking the dog, and I was looking up, and I said, that has to be the International Space Station. It's so big, and, you know, the lights.
It was very bright.
But all of a sudden it moved sideways. And then I said, okay. No, I can't have another UFO sighting. No one will take me seriously. So I don't know what it was. It might have been atmospheric or something, but anyway, that was interesting. I don't really know what it was.
But, yeah, it's very hard to tell what lights in the sky could be from time to time.
Yeah.
It is.
Patrick, thank
you very much, and have a nice day.
Yeah.
Send me an email, Patrick.
That's within Sweden.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
It's time for you to go to bed. Bye-bye. It's 2 o'clock in the morning now. All right.
Thank you.
All right, good night.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
All right.
We have about 7 minutes or so left. So if anyone wants to give a ring, you can do so. Otherwise, I'm taking down the number for pretty soon here. So what's next on the on your agenda? You say you write a book a year?
So
you must have something planned.
I'm writing a book about things that fall from the sky right now. It will be published in... September. So, I mean, it could be anything. It could be meteorites. It could be frogs, fish. It could be radiation from the sun. Things that affect human beings and the earth that falls from the sky. It's fortune stuff. And I think it could be a very interesting read. That's my main topic right now. But also, UFO Sweden is 50 years in April.
Wow.
Which we will have a 3-day conference and exhibition with Chris Orbeck, who is the big guy who knows everything about UFOs before 1947. He will be giving a talk, and also Dave Clark, who was the British professor who saved the files from destruction when it comes to the British defense UFO files. So both of them will be here in Sweden giving talks, and we will open AFU for everyone to visit as well. So that is also a very big thing for us. And going to Britain again to save some more stuff in April.
What type of storage space do you have there? You must have a lot.
You know, we have Bob Rickard, who is the publisher, was the publisher of Fortean Times. We live in his house in the north of London, and his basement is the storage place for everything bring there. And after that, we send it by a lorry to Sweden.
So I see.
That's the plan this time again.
Wow. Well, interesting. And so if someone actually had something they wanted to donate to you, they could reach out to you basically. And what do you tell them as far as, you know, how these things are cared for?
We are very, very skilled with taking care of material that people send to us. We have done this since 1973. Hmm. And we are very, very, you can say, we don't throw anything away. Everything is saved. And if something is broken, we mend it. Mm-hmm. So if anyone wants to get in contact with AFU, you have all the contacts on AFU.se. And we also need, of course, donations in form of money to keep us running, to help you out there to get information from us. That is the most important thing right now. We're looking for a new locality to move to so we can have one roof over everything we have instead of 14 different localities. Mm. And if we can do that, we will have a museum there as well and be more efficient in scanning and more efficient in helping people.
Yeah. When you scan, I mean, scanning it just takes so long, doesn't it? So much time.
It does. At one point, we had several people doing the scannings. Right now, we only have one, or I should say two, because one of our board members is doing a huge scanning project at his house as well. But two people are good, but it should be 10 people scanning because we have scanned maybe 3% of everything we have. We have millions of things that we want to scan, but we haven't had time to do.
Wow, millions of things. See, I can believe that. Wow, excellent. Well, so we are right at the end of our show, and I want to thank you so much, Klaus. As always, it's always a lot of fun to speak with you. And I know you stayed up really late, and I wanted to let you know I really do appreciate that.
Oh, it's not a problem. I'm glad to be on your show, and it's a pleasure, really.
Yeah. You're one of the people I consider a friend that I've, you know, have met through this crazy topic.
Absolutely. The very same to you, Marty.
Yes.
Very same.
All right. You take care.
Take care as well.
All right.
Good luck with your show.
All right. Thanks a lot. Okay, good night. All right, everyone, so that is it for our show this evening. Next week, we have Chris O'Brien is going to be back with us. So that should he's always a character. It should be a lot of fun. So tune in next week for that. And again, I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. And remember, anyone can support the show. Go over to podcastufo.com. All that information's there, and our t-shirts are for sale also. So t-shirts and all types of things with a nice graphic that Diane Cash made for us with the Podcast UFO logo on it. So anyway, check that out. And again, we'll be back next week. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.